foggy, and the harp sprinkled between them. They moaned and panted, and held on to the loved ones they had nearly lost. It looked like something the twins would have seen on the news after a natural disaster had occurred.
"Where are we?"
Alex asked.
"Doesn't matter," Connor asked. "We're alive."
The twins and their friends gathered together in the center of the field.
"That was a very brave thing you did back there," Jack said, and placed a grateful hand on Alex's shoulder.
"You saved our lives, Alex," Goldilocks said.
Trollbella strolled up to Alex. Her headdress had been knocked off, and her blonde pigtails were exposed.
"You saved me and my troblins, squishy girl," she said. "We will forever be grateful."
All Alex could do was nod, overwhelmed by the gratitude she was receiving. She dumped out the satchel, and all their belongings the troll had briefly stolen from them fell on the ground. Jack took his axe, and Goldilocks took her sword. Alex watched as the Wand of Wonderment reconfigured itself as the pieces of Mirror, the Scepter, the Stepmother's Ring, and the Sea Witch's Pearls were reunited.
"A whole kingdom has been ruined, but it looks like something can be salvaged," Alex said.
She picked up her mother's silver engagement ring off the ground and handed it to Bob. It gave them hope that everything hadn't been lost. Jack led a group of troll and goblin men into the woods and returned with firewood. They set up a series of campfires for the night. Bob walked around and inspected anyone that had been injured in the escape, although he was a little confused by troll and goblin anatomy. Some four-toed feet weren't actually missing any toes. Everyone slept on the ground that night. The next day, the granny's crash site was discovered not too far away from the trolls and goblins' camp. The ship's damage was irreparable, so they stripped it apart and used the pieces of woven wood and stitched fabric to create tents for the campers. While Jack was helping the trolls and goblins tear the ship apart, he found Claudius hiding in the destruction. Jack brought him back to the camp, and he was reunited with Red.
"Oh, Claudius, there you are," Red said happily. "I was worried sick. I was afraid you had been gobbled up by, a relative or something."
They configured a tent for their group of 8, 9 including Claudius, to sleep under. Trollbella insisted on putting her tent as close as possible to the one Connor slept in. She talked openly about their future wedding, although he had never given her an answer to her proposal.
"Trollbella, you and all the Troblins just lost a kingdom," he said. "I think you have bigger things to worry about."
"You are so wise, Butter Boy," Trollbella said, "and someday you will make a wonderful Butter King."
Trollbella was homeless, but still not hopeless. Jack, Goldilocks, Red, Froggy Bob, and the twins sat around a campfire that evening. They were feeling pretty dismal after witnessing the Enchantress's attempt to kill an entire kingdom.
"Where do we go now?" Goldilocks asked.
"We've collected everything except what we need from the Enchantress."
"And no one has any clue where she is?" Bob asked.
"No," Jack said. "But as soon as we do, it'll be our next stop."
Connor grew tired of hearing the same pointless questions being asked.
"I'm going for a walk," he said. "I need to clear my head."
"I'll go with you," Alex said. "Some air will do us some good."
The twins walked into the trees beside the campground. It was nice to have time away from the others and vent to each other.
"She's such a monster," Alex said under her breath. "I don't think I've ever hated someone as much as I hate the Enchantress."
"I never thought one person was capable of so much damage," Connor said.
"When are we going to have the answers we need to get rid of this wench? I'm so sick of asking questions."
Something began moving between the trees in the distance. The twins looked up and saw a familiar ghostly woman floating toward them.
"It's the Lady of the East," Alex said.
The ghost hovered in front of them. Connor took an angry step toward her. He wasn't afraid of the spirit anymore, but had grown very frustrated by her appearance.
"What do you want from us?" he yelled.
The ghost didn't respond. She just stared at the twins silently, as she always did.
"Habla ingles,"
Connor tried with a horrible accent.
"Connor, I don't think she speaks Spanish," Alex reprimanded.
"What do you want?" Connor shouted.
The ghost raised her hand and pointed to the east.
"Yes, we get it. You're from the east," Connor said. "Listen, ghost lady, we've got a lot on our plate right now. Unless you can help us, please go haunt someone else."
The ghost looked back and forth between the twins and nodded. She turned around and floated off into the trees, but stopped to look back at them. It was the most the twins had ever seen her move.
"I think she wants us to follow her," Alex said. "I think she wants to help."
The ghost nodded and then floated off into the distance.
"Why are ghosts so passive-aggressive?" Connor asked.
"Let's follow her," Alex said with a shrug. "What do we have to lose?"
Connor eyed the ghost nervously. You better not be taking us on a wild ghost chase. The twins followed the spirit through the trees and into the east. They had no idea where she was taking them or how long they would be gone, but the twins hoped wherever they were going, they would find the answers they needed. It was a few hours past sunset, and the magic harp had the tent all to herself. The twins had gone for a walk, and the others were gathered around the campfire just outside, quietly talking among themselves. The harp gazed through a tear in the tent at the trolls and the goblins camping around her. Even though they had kidnapped her and forced her to play music, she couldn't help but feel sorry for them. No creature deserved to have its home destroyed in such a merciless manner. She wished there was a way she could help the twins stop the enchantress, except for the obvious one. The Wand of Wonderment was resting on a tree stump on the ground in front of the harp. She had been keeping as much distance from the wand as possible. Every time she saw it, a strange, alluring sensation swept through her, as if she was being magnetically drawn to it. The harp knew she was meant to be part of the wand. She just worried what her incorporation would cost her.
"So tragic," said an airy voice in the tent. "I gave the Troll Queen a proper warning, so she only has herself to blame."
The harp turned to see who had snuck into the tent behind her, and she saw a face she hadn't seen in more than 100 years.
"Esmia," the harp said.
"Hello, Gloria," the enchantress said. "It's been ages since the last time I saw you. You look wonderful. Haven't aged a day. Then again, I suppose that's one of the perks of being made of gold."
The harp was neither timid nor scared. Unbeknownst to the others, the harp and the enchantress had a history together.
"You should know," the harp said crossly. "Or has your memory spoiled as much as your soul? You're the one who transformed me into this instrument."
"Was that me?"
Esmia said, and playfully gestured to herself.
"The musician fell in love with me and left you. You turned me into an object and captured his soul so I would be forced to live forever and spend eternity without him."
"How cruel," Esmia said. "Sounds like something I would do, though."
If the harp had had tear ducts, Esmia would have caused tears to roll down her golden face.
"Why are you here, Esmia?" the harp said. "Are you tallying all the lives you've ruined?"
The enchantress smiled malevolently.
"No, I came to see that expression on your face. I've waited over 100 years to see those eyes fill with the bleakness of seeing your whole world crumble around you," she said, "because you were responsible for putting that same look into my eyes once."
"You still blame me for the musician's mistake," the harp said.
"Oh, please, the fault was shared," Esmia said. "You let him pursue you even though you knew it was breaking my heart. You didn't think hurting me would have a consequence, because, like the rest of the world, you thought I was powerful in ability, but weak in spirit."
"And now are you satisfied?" the harp asked. "Now that you've shown the world the evil you're capable of, have you found your peace?"
"I may not be fully satisfied yet, but I will be soon," Esmia said. "I have big plans for this world."
The harp shook her head, almost pitying the enchantress.
"No, Esmia. You'll never be satisfied," she said. "You think by robbing other people of their bliss, you'll find your own, but it doesn't work that way. You'll be searching for happiness your entire life, but will never find it, because you wouldn't know what happiness was, even if it scratched you in the face."
The enchantress's eyes grew wide with anger. Her hair was rapidly flowing above her like an aggressive flame. The harp might have infuriated her, but she was delighted by the feeling. Esmia smiled as her spirit absorbed the emotion and her body became stronger.
"Thank you," Esmia said. "I have a big day tomorrow and needed that extra boost. But one thing before I go, if I do search for bliss forever, I'm so glad you'll be around to see it."
The enchantress vanished from the tent without a trace. The remark was like a knife in the heart to the harp. She couldn't bear the thought of watching Esmia's wrath evolve for all time. She looked down at the Wand of Wonderment and reached toward it. She was ready to sacrifice whatever she had to, so Esmia didn't win. Chapter 23. The Eighth Dwarf. A horrible storm moved through the dwarf forests. Rain poured down in massive amounts, trees bent in the violent wind, and thunder roared across the land. It was as if Mother Nature was mourning. The 7 dwarfs were nestled warmly in their cottage. They played a game of cards and enjoyed some hot cocoa at their table while they waited out the storm. It was almost midnight when an unexpected knock came from their door. The dwarves were very curious as to who would be visiting them so late in the night during such a harsh storm. In fact, the last person to knock on their door had been Queen Snow White herself when she was just a young princess trying to hide from the evil queen. The oldest dwarf stood from the table and opened the door. He was taken aback by who their guest turned out to be. Standing on their doorstep, soaked to the bone in a dark cloak, was the seven dwarfs' youngest brother.
"Hello," Rumpelstiltskin said.
"Well, I'll be an elf's mistress," the oldest dwarf said.
It had been 127 years since the dwarfs had seen their youngest brother.
"Rumpelstiltskin, is that you?" said the shortest dwarf, and he stood from the table.
"It's me, brother," Rumpelstiltskin said. "May I come in?"
The oldest hesitated at first, but because the weather was so horrid, he decided it would be cruel of him not to let his brother in. Rumpelstiltskin took a step inside his old home, and the oldest shut the door behind him.
"It's a beast out there," he said with a shiver.
All seven of his brothers scowled at him, not welcoming his return home.
"Playing with the old deck, I see. I always loved it when we played cards through a storm."
His brothers stared at the floor, or rather hands of cards, although none of them were playing anymore.
"I saw the smoke from your chimney," Rumpelstiltskin said. "It guided me here through the storm. Thank goodness it did. Otherwise I would still be out there trotting through the rain."
"Why are you here?"
the largest dwarf asked him. Rumpelstiltskin looked at his hands while he formed the words.
"I snuck away while the enchantress was out. I'm sure you've heard, but she's taking over the world," he said.
The oldest dwarf hooted under his breath in disgust and had a seat at the table. Rumpelstiltskin knew it was aimed at him.
"She isn't very clear about her plans for the dwarf forests, as it has no ruler to conquer, but I think she's planning on obliterating them completely," he said. "I'm fairly close to her, as close as anyone could be, and was hoping with your permission I could ask her to spare you when she takes over."
"And why would you do that?" asked the thinnest dwarf.
Rumpelstiltskin was hurt he had to be asked.
"Because we're family," he said.
The oldest angrily threw his cards on the table.
"We were family," he said. "You abandoned this family a long time ago when you decided we weren't good enough for you. And what did you leave us for? To kidnap children for evil fairies? To spend a lifetime in prison? How dare you call yourself a dwarf or say the word family under this roof? Mother and father would be ashamed of you if they were still alive."
Rumpelstiltskin lowered his head.
"I was so unhappy," he said. "I didn't know what I wanted. I just knew it wasn't the life of a miner."
"So have you found it, then?" the shortest dwarf asked. "Is running around doing the evil enchantress's grunt work been everything you were hoping for?"
Rumpelstiltskin closed his eyes. He was hoping the conversation wouldn't get to this.
"I'm sorry for the embarrassment I brought to this family," he said. "And believe me, not a day goes by that I don't wish to erase the past. I would love nothing more than to get rid of my affiliation with her, but I'm afraid I can't. All because of one mistake I made years ago."
The oldest dwarf shuffled his cards.
"Well, it was your mistake, not ours," he said. "We'll have nothing to do with it. You can tell the enchantress that we would rather die than live in a world ruled by her."
Rumpelstiltskin looked to his other brothers, but the answer seemed to be unanimous.
"I see," he said. "Well, at least I tried."
He headed to the door and pulled it open. The strong winds from outside instantly filled the cottage. Rumpelstiltskin turned back to his brothers before he left. He had one final thing to say.
"I'm sorry I could never be the brother you wanted," Rumpelstiltskin said. "But one day, I'll make things right between us. One day, I'll be a brother you can be proud of."
Rumpelstiltskin stepped into the storm and shut the cottage door behind him, knowing it could very well be the last thing he ever said to them. Chapter 24. The Lady of the East. The twins followed the ghost for hours and hours across the land. They traveled through a series of forests, over streams, and across grassy hills as they voyaged farther and farther, following the spirit into the east. Occasionally, the ghost would look back at the twins to make sure they were still following her and wait for them to catch up before proceeding. Eventually, they arrived at a large river that marked the Eastern Kingdom's border. At least, the twins assumed it was the border, since everything on the opposite side was consumed in thorn bushes and vines.
"She's crazy if she thinks we're going in there," Connor said.
The Lady of the East floated upstream to a large maple tree. She lingered by its roots until the twins met her there. She pointed to the ground, and the twins saw a small circular door hidden in the dirt. Connor pulled it open and discovered a ladder leading down into a narrow tunnel.
It's a secret passage, Alex said.
Are we supposed to go in there? Connor asked the ghost. The Lady of the East slowly nodded her head. She retracted into a small, ghostly orb and flew into the passage. Alex and Connor followed her, cautiously making their way down the ladder. The tunnel was dark and dingy. The orb gave off the only light, and the twins followed it like the North Star as it continued leading them east underground. The dirt surrounding them became moist and muddy as they traveled below the river.
She seems to know where she's going, Connor said.
This must be a secret entrance into the Eastern Kingdom, Alex said. Something tells me we're the only ones who've been here for a very long time.
There were no footprints or a single insect or rodent in sight. The twins were led through the tunnel for miles and miles. Their feet grew tired and ached a little more with every step.
Are we there yet? Connor asked the orb, but he didn't get an answer.
Finally, the tunnel came to an end at another ladder. Alex and Connor climbed up the ladder and peeked through another circular door above it. They pushed the door open and climbed out of the passage. The twins found themselves in a square room with hay covering the ground and spacious wooden stalls built around the walls.
Looks like we're in a stable, Connor said.
Then where are all the horses? Alex asked.
The orb expanded back into the Lady of the East. She glided across the stable and through a pair of open wooden doors. Alex and Connor followed her, peering through the doors before walking through them. They found a stone spiral staircase that twisted high above them.
Connor, I think we're in Sleeping Beauty's castle, Alex said.
The Lady of the East glared at them from the stairs.
We're coming, Connor said.
The twins followed the ghost up the stony steps, climbing higher and higher into the castle. They finally reached one of the highest floors and followed the Lady of the East down a hallway with stained glass windows. The windows were dark, though, as if something was covering them from the other side. They passed a window with an unobstructed view and looked out at the rest of the castle and the land surrounding it. Alex shrieked and grabbed her brother's arm.
Oh my gosh, she said and covered her mouth.
Whoa,
Connor said under his breath. The castle was so consumed by the Enchantress's plants, it looked like it was one large plant itself. The thorn bushes and vines had wrapped around the castle, leaving nothing uncovered. The twins saw soldiers and servants and villagers spread across the land with vines coiled around them like serpents covering their prey. Some were pinned to the ground, while others were suspended hundreds of feet in the air over the castle, like ornaments on a monstrous Christmas tree.
You don't see something like that every day, Connor said softly.
The twins turned to the Lady of the East. She floated farther down the hall and phased through a door. Alex and Connor opened the door and walked into the room, but the ghost had vanished. They looked around at the room they had just entered, and a large, luxurious four-poster bed pushed against the wall caught their eye. They were in the king and queen's chambers.
Who are you? A deep voice called out.
King Chase was seated by a fireplace, keeping warm. The twins jumped when they saw him.
So sorry to disturb you, Alex said. We didn't realize we were walking into your private chambers.
The king studied them curiously.
How did you get into the castle? He asked.
We were following someone, Alex said.
Who?
King Chase asked.
Neither of the twins had an answer. Well, we're not sure who she is exactly, Alex said.
A pushy ghost, that's who, Connor said under his breath.
She led us through a secret tunnel.
The twins expected the king to look at them like they were crazy, but he did the opposite.
A ghost, King Chase said. Is this ghost, by chance, the spirit of a woman with a flower in her hair?
Yes, Alex said. Do you know who she is?
King Chase nodded.
You must have been following the ghost of old Queen Beauty. She's been haunting this castle for years.
Queen Beauty? Connor asked with a confused face. But we just saw your wife last week. She's alive.
King Chase rested his head on the back of his chair and let out a long sigh of relief.
I'm glad to hear that, he said. I haven't seen or heard from her since she fled the castle. No one has been able to get in or out since the plants attacked.
So there are two Queen Beauties? Connor asked. King Chase stood and walked to a portrait on the wall. It was of a beautiful woman, unmistakably the Lady of the East when she had been alive.
The ghost is the spirit of my wife's grandmother, Queen Beauty the First, who she was named after, King Chase explained. Historically speaking, my wife is Queen Beauty the Second. The world just knows her as Sleeping Beauty. That's why she looks so familiar, Connor said. Sleeping Beauty looks just like her grandmother. The ghost only reveals herself to people she thinks can help in a time of need,
King Chase said, and eyed the twins.
I should know. I would have never kissed Sleeping Beauty and broken the sleeping curse if Queen Beauty hadn't been there to guide me to this castle.
Interesting, Alex said, and studied the portrait. Beside it was another painting of Queen Beauty, standing next to a large animal of some kind. It had thick fur, large claws, and a mane like a lion's.
Wait a second. Beauty, Alex thought.
Is old Queen Beauty the beauty from the story of Beauty and the Beast?
Indeed, said a woman's voice.
The twins and King Chase turned to see the ghost of old Queen Beauty floating toward them.
I came to live in the castle when I was a very young woman. I was meant to settle my father's debt with a king cursed to live as a hideous beast, but when I fell in love with him, the curse was lifted, and he became human again.
The twins froze.
You can talk? Connor asked. Might have been nice if you explained some of this the first time you scared the crap out of us.
I apologize for my methods getting you here, Beauty said. I can only speak when I am in my old home.
Alex was fascinated by the heritage, and silently thought on it, trying to make sense of it all.
So there were two curses in this castle broken by an act of love, Alex said. What a coincidence.
That is not a coincidence at all, I'm afraid, Beauty said. The curses were cast by the same person, Esmia.
Both the twins shook their head in disbelief. They weren't expecting this twist in the story. Hold on, Connor said. Esmia is who turned your husband into the beast? The ghost nodded somberly.
Yes, she said. You see, Esmia fell in love with my husband long before I met him. When he could not reciprocate her love, she cursed him, thinking no one could ever love a beast.
And then you broke the spell, and years later she cursed your granddaughter?
Alex asked. Guess she didn't like the name Beauty, Connor said with a shrug.
The Enchantress has cursed every generation of my family, Beauty told them. She bewitched my son into desiring a wife who could spin hay into gold. He eventually found a maiden who claimed to do so, but only because she made a deal with Rumpelstiltskin to do it for her.
And Rumpelstiltskin was working for Esmia at the time, Connor said, piecing everything together. He spun the hay into gold in exchange for her firstborn child.
Wait, there's a theme in Esmia's attacks on your family, Alex said. They all involve a spinning wheel. But why?
Before I came to live in the castle with the beast, my sisters and I spun thread in the village nearby, Beauty said. Esmia couldn't stand the fact that my husband chose to love a spinner rather than a great fairy like herself. She has forced the spinning wheel upon my family since.
That takes a lot of effort, Connor said.
Why would she put so much energy into cursing your family because of something that happened so long ago?
The twins could almost see a small smile appear on the ghost's face. The twins were following her story perfectly.
Because the Enchantress, above all things, values her pride, Beauty said. And my family has always been a reminder of Esmia's greatest loss and embarrassment.
The twins felt their hearts skip a beat.
Her pride, Alex said. That's it. That's the Enchantress's most prized possession.
That's why you brought us here, isn't it? Connor asked Beauty.
You knew what we needed.
The ghost of old Queen Beauty nodded again. King Chase was just as caught up in her story as the twins were, still learning things about the family he married into.
I have a question, King Chase said. Is that why you haunt this castle still? Because you're protecting your family against the Enchantress?
The ghost dismally lowered her head.
In her scheme to take over the world, the Enchantress imprisoned my husband's soul, just as she has your grandmother, Beauty said to the twins. I have walked the earth waiting for his soul to be free, so I can be reunited with him on the other side.
What's up with all the souls? Connor asked. Can't she collect stamps or antiques like a normal person?
I'm afraid I don't have the answer to that question, Beauty said, but I've asked someone who will to join us.
The ghost of old Queen Beauty gestured behind them to the fireplace. Another spirit stepped out from the smoke of the tiny flames. It was the ghost of a short woman who wore a hooded cloak and walked hunched over with a cane. Her face was so wrinkled she looked like a log. She had an incredibly small nose, with an enormous mole next to it. The twins knew who she was, without any introduction. Their father had described her perfectly in the journal they had followed a year ago.
Hagatha? Alex asked. Is that you?
Aye, Hagatha said,
and slowly made her way closer to them.
Do you know why the Enchantress is collecting souls?
Connor cautiously asked her.
Aye, Hagatha said. It's what she needs to create a portal into the other world.
What?
Alex asked breathlessly.
What do you mean, the other world?
The Enchantress never wanted just this world. She always planned on taking over the other world as well, Hagatha said. It's her home. It's where she was born. It's where her family was killed.
The twins couldn't believe what they were hearing. As if the stakes weren't high enough already, learning that the Enchantress wanted to take over their world, too, made them sick to their stomachs. Their quest suddenly became a mission to save two worlds. The mayhem she could cause in the other world would be catastrophic compared to the havoc she had committed here.
But our grandmother is the only person who can travel between worlds, Alex said.
Hagatha and Beauty exchanged a remorseful look.
There is another way, Hagatha said. It's something I learned when I was a young witch. It was such an extreme spell, I never thought anyone would be crazy enough to attempt it, until I met Esmia.
And you gave it to her? Alex asked.
I met her when she was still a fairy in good standing, Hagatha said in her own defense. She had been heartbroken a number of times and asked me if I knew how to create a portal so she could go home to the other world. And not thinking much of it, I made the biggest mistake of my life. I told her.
What was it? Connor asked.
Hagatha let out a long sigh.
To travel into the other world, you must first master the 7 deadly sins of this world and conquer its past, present, and future, she said.
It was the most intense collecting spell the twins had ever heard of.
She has to master the 7 deadly sins? Alex asked.
And conquer this world's past, present, and future? Connor said. How does someone do that?
Esme has spent a long time figuring it out, and unfortunately, she's very close to completing it, Hagatha said.
What are the 7 deadly sins again?
Connor asked his sister. Alex had to think about it.
Lust, envy, pride, greed, gluttony, sloth, and wrath, I believe, she said.
Connor gulped. Sounds like the Enchantress, all right, he said.
And you said she's close to accomplishing all of that, Hagatha?
The ghost of the old witch nodded.
Esme has imprisoned the souls of her former loves to signify her lust. She strips others of their happiness to signify her envy. Having Rumpelstiltskin under her command connotes her sloth. And as she slowly takes over this world, with greed and gluttony, the world is exposed to the Enchantress's wrath, satisfying her pride, Hagatha said.
But how is she conquering this world's past, present, and future?
Alex asked.
By destroying the kingdom's historical landmarks, the Enchantress conquers the past, Hagatha explained. By forcing the rulers to hand over the thrones willingly, Esmia undeniably holds the power over the present. And by kidnapping the heir to a throne of man and the heir to a throne of magic, she encompasses the future.
The twins bobbed their heads up and down as they followed along. They looked at King Chase, but he was having an even harder time comprehending it all. Every move Esmia had made from the very beginning had been carefully calculated.
Princess Hope is the heir to a throne of man, Connor said. That's why Esmia kidnapped her and tried kidnapping Sleeping Beauty as a baby.
But who's the heir to the throne of magic? Alex asked.
That is where the Enchantress has made her greatest mistake, Hagatha said,
happy to tell them about one advantage they had over the Enchantress.
She has taken the wrong person.
The twins didn't understand what she was telling them at first. Connor looked to his sister as it slowly dawned on him. Alex realized everyone in the room was looking at her.
Me? Alex asked and pointed to herself. That's why the Enchantress wanted to kidnap me? She thinks I'm some sort of heir to magic?
Technically, you are the fairy godmother's only heir, Connor said.
You're her grandchild, too, Alex reminded him. Shouldn't you qualify as much as me?
Connor shook his head.
Come on, Alex, he said. You know I've never wanted to be a fairy. This has always been your thing.
Alex shook her head and looked at the floor, not wanting to believe it.
No, there has to be some sort of mistake, she said. I want to be a fairy as much as the next girl, but I can't be the next fairy godmother.
Didn't the unicorns bow to you when you came to this world?
Beauty asked.
Well, yes, but what does that have to do with anything?
Alex asked.
The unicorns only bow to those that magic is strong with, Hagatha said. Esmia knew that if anyone could stop her, it would be another woman of both worlds with magic in her blood.
Which is why Grandma made such a big deal about protecting us, Connor said. She knew Esmia would be coming after you. I bet she's known you were going to fill her shoes since you activated her Land of Stories book.
Alex kept trying to deny it to herself, but what they were saying was making sense. It was a huge reality to face, but an even bigger burden to bear. Had the situation been different, it would have been the most wonderful news she had ever heard in her life. But they were talking as if she was now single-handedly responsible for defeating the Enchantress.
"You have to get back to the others," said another voice in the room. They all turned to see a third ghost appear. She was young and pretty, but shy and kept her distance. There was something about her presence and her voice that was so familiar to the twins, but they had so many things to think about, they couldn't think exactly who she reminded them of.
"This room's getting more crowded by the minute," Connor said. "Who are you?"
The new ghost took a moment to answer, as if she wanted to remain anonymous. "They called me Gloria when I was alive," she said, but quickly changed the subject. "You've been gone for hours, and your friends have started to worry. The Enchantress is planning another attack soon. You must return to them and finish building the wand."
"Wait, how do you know about the wand?" Connor asked.
The ghost of Gloria went silent. "I know you're much closer to finishing it than you think," she said softly, almost sad to say it. "Now you must hurry. Esme is planning to strike very soon."
"She's right," Beauty said. She floated past the twins and headed to the door. "It's time you headed back to the troll and goblin camp."
The twins nodded, not wanting to cause Bob and the others to worry any more than they already had.
"Children," King Chase said before they left his room, "if you see my wife, please tell her I love her."
"No," Connor said, "but you can tell her yourself when you see her next." He and King Chase shared a hopeful smile.
"Best of luck to you both," the king said.
The twins followed the ghost of Old Queen Beauty out of the room. She escorted them down the spiral staircase, through the stables, and into the secret passage. The twins ran down through the tunnel as fast as they could, reaching the other ladder in half the time it took them to get there. They quickly hurried through the trees, over the streams, and across the hills, and finally reached the woods alongside the campsite as the sun began to rise. They turned back to the ghost of Old Queen Beauty.
"Thank you," Alex said. "You helped us so much."
The ghost silently nodded her head and then disappeared. They could tell she was just as grateful to them as they were to her. The twins ran through the campsite and found Bob and Froggy sitting at the campfire outside the tent.
"That was the longest walk I've ever heard of," Bob exclaimed when he saw them.
"Where have you been?"
"We were worried sick," Froggy said, and leaped to his feet.
"We were in the Eastern Kingdom," Connor panted. "We have so much to tell you guys."
Alex looked around. "Where is everyone anyway?" she asked. Froggy and Bob looked at each other with sorrowful eyes. The twins instantly knew something bad must have happened while they were gone.
"What's wrong?" Connor asked.
Froggy didn't know how to explain.
"Come have a look for yourselves," he said.
He led the twins inside the tent. Inside, the twins saw Jack kneeling sadly on the ground. Goldilocks was standing at his side, gently rubbing his back. Red sat next to Jack and cuddled Claudius tightly in her arms.
"What happened?" Alex asked.
"It's the hop," Goldilocks said. "She's gone."
"What do you mean she's gone?" Connor asked.
"She's part of the wand now," Jack said. "We came into the tent and found it like this."
Jack was clutching the Wand of Wonderment. It had a shiny new golden tint to it now, the exact shade of the harp. Red used part of Goldilocks' coat as a handkerchief to blow her nose.
"Poor dear," she said. "I suppose the singer has taken her final bow."
"I never thought we would lose her completely to it," Jack said,
fighting back the emotion that had suddenly rushed through him.
"I wish we could have had more time to figure out a better way."
Alex and Connor looked to each other and knew exactly what the other was thinking.
"Gloria," Connor whispered to Alex. "The harp's name was Gloria."
Alex watched over her sad friends and took a step toward them, deciding now was the best time to tell them what they had learned from the spirits in Sleeping Beauty's castle.
"The harp's loss won't be in vain," she said. "We finally know what we need to defeat the Enchantress."
Chapter 25. Rock, Root, and Rage. The golden arches and pillars of the fairy palace could barely contain the anxieties growing inside them. The seven colorful fairies of the fairy council paced around the main hall away from their respected podiums, desperately trying to come up with an overdue solution to the crisis at hand.
"A whole territory has been destroyed," Xantha said.
The flames on his head and shoulders were flickering wildly.
"We need to find her."
"Every corner of every kingdom has been searched twice, and there still is no trace of her," said Emeralda.
But what would we do if we found her? Skylene asked. We're no match for the Enchantress.
Our magic is useless against hers, Rosette added, and she grows more powerful every day.
But we must do something, anything, Xanthus demanded. The world is counting on us.
Tangerina had grown tired of his complaining. Even her bees were irritated and flew around her beehive with their stingers out.
Then why don't you think of something to do? She said. We've all been in here for days trying to come up with a practical solution. It's not like we're keeping anything from you.
If we can't come up with a practical solution, then I suggest we come up with an impractical solution,
Xanthus half-heartedly suggested.
Let's fight her at her own game. Who cares about honoring our fairy values?
The flames on Xanthus' shoulders flickered faster as he thought about it.
The world has always looked to us to handle its troubles with peace and understanding. We cannot abandon those morals now. That's what the Enchantress wants, Emeralda said. You can't extinguish a fire by adding more flame. You of all people should know that, Xanthus.
Then if we can't use our magic to stop her, let's gather all the witches and warlocks from the Dwarf Forest and Pinocchio Prison and have them defeat her, he proposed.
Emeralda massaged her forehead.
You want to let loose the witches and warlocks that we imprisoned? She asked him.
Xanthus' flames diminished, and he slumped. She didn't have to elaborate for him to realize how bad an idea this was.
Any more bright ideas? Tangerina asked him.
Xanthus turned to respond to her, but had nothing to say. They were at a dead end.
What if we can't come up with an answer?
Coral asked in a tiny voice, cuddling her pet walking fish.
Will all of us perish if we can't stop her?
The situation had finally reached a point that forced them to consider the consequences of failing. Emeralda eyed her fellow fairies, angered by their sudden hopelessness.
Shame on all of you, Emeralda said,
and walked around the room. She stared directly into each of their eyes as she passed them.
We are the Fairy Council. If we lose our hope, all hope for the rest of the world is as good as gone. We cannot spend a moment humoring thoughts of failure. As long as someone remains standing with a noble heart, there will always be a way for good to triumph over evil.
The other fairies looked around at one another, inspired by Emeralda's words. Moments like these were the reason why Emeralda was the head of the fairy council. A small magenta flame abruptly appeared on the floor of the main hall. It came out of thin air and didn't appear to be burning anything but the air around it. Emeralda gazed down at it and cautiously stepped away.
"Brace yourselves," she said, and her green eyes grew large. "We're about to have company."
With a giant blast, the purple flame rapidly grew into a roaring magenta fire that covered the majority of the room. The fairies screamed and shielded themselves from the blaze. A split second later, the flames vanished and the Enchantress appeared. The fairies froze with fear. Esmia always knew how to make an entrance.
"It's good to be home,"
Esmia laughed and looked around the room at all the frightened faces of her old peers.
"For people who thought I was dead, you never look happy to see me."
Emeralda was the only fairy brave enough to address her.
"Why have you come here, Esmia?"
The Enchantress ignored the question.
"Oh, look,"
Esmia said happily. She strutted to a forgotten golden chair that had been pushed to the side of the room.
"It's my old seat from when I was on the Fairy Council. Remember those days?"
"You've certainly shown your true colors since," Emeralda said.
"You act as if you're all so faultless," Esmia sneered. "I can see right through that pathetic facade of a perfect loving family. I know how spiteful you can be when no one is looking. I sat in this room for hours every day trying to make the world a better place, just as much as the rest of you. But why did you target me with your cruelty? Why was I treated so poorly by the people who are supposed to be perfect?"
"Because you became vindictive," Emeralda said.
"No," Esmia said and shook her head. "It was because I became better. I was more powerful, more gifted, and more liked than any of you could ever be. When the fairy godmother announced me as her heir, you acted as if I had done something horrible to you. She put me on a pedestal, and you all isolated me there. As your ability grew, so did your ego," Emeralda said. "You thought you were above us. You even renounced your title as a fairy." "You're the ones who renounced me long before I ever did,"
Esmia said, and glared at her.
"You ignored me, excluded me, and hated me from the minute I arrived. The world may be convinced you had nothing to do with my change of career, but I will always know the truth.
You made it impossible for me to be anything but disdained.
The Enchantress ran a finger on the arm of her old chair, remembering all the painful memories of her time as a fairy.
The cruelest thing you can do to someone is force them to hurt alone, and you left me hurting on my own many times, Esmia said. Every time I was heartbroken, I would go to the rest of you hoping to receive some compassion, but you let your jealousies get in the way of showing any sympathy. You actually enjoyed watching me suffer, relishing in the fact that something was distressing me.
Emeralda surprised the Enchantress and the other fairies with what she said next. She didn't deny it.
I admit that even we are guilty of being less than perfect at times, Emeralda said. But as we've grown from our mistakes, your mistakes have only grown.
Esmia snorted and slowly clapped in Emeralda's direction.
Touché, the Enchantress said. You managed to admit you were wrong and scold me in one breath. You're good at this leadership thing, Em. No wonder they replaced me with you.
I was not a replacement, Emeralda said. You were never what this council needed.
No, I was never what this council wanted, Esmia said sharply. They chose you, Emeralda, because you were more beautiful, and the world always listens to a pretty face over an average one. And even though I changed my appearance and gained beauty over time, they still chose you over me because you were easier to control. You were the fairy godmother's puppet I could never be.
Emeralda returned her scornful stare.
I'd rather be a toy than a tyrant, Esmia, she said. But I'm assuming you didn't come here to reminisce. So what brings you to our kingdom?
A small grin appeared on the Enchantress's face. She was delighted to get a rise out of the fairy.
The truth is, I've become rather bored waiting for you and the other rulers to gradually hand the kingdoms over to me,
Esmia said, taking a seat on her old chair.
I've decided to invite them all to the new home I'm building for myself and get it all over with. I'm anxious for this whole thing to conclude as much as you all are.
None of us are going anywhere with you, Xanthus said, and his flames rose.
A cunning smirk grew on the Enchantress's face.
Oh, yes, you are, Esmia said. It's not an option.
The Enchantress snapped her fingers, and the ground started to rumble with the power of a dozen earthquakes. All the fairies looked to one another, petrified of what was coming their way. Clusters of vines exploded out of the floor and seized the fairies in the room. They desperately tried to free themselves, struggling against the plants with all their might and all their magic, but it was no use. The plants were too strong to escape. Esmia roared with laughter as she watched the vines coil around each fairy council member and drag them into the ground. Emeralda sank her hands into the ground to prevent the vines from dragging her away.
You won't win, Esmia, she said.
Oh, but I will,
the Enchantress said,
looking down at her with a smile in her eyes.
You see, I'm finally building my own pedestal, but this time, rather than admiration, I'm building it from rock, root, and rage.
Things were gloomy as ever at the Charming Palace. All the other rulers had gone home after the Happily Ever After assembly meeting, except for Sleeping Beauty, who had no choice but to stay. She sat with Cinderella in her chambers, quietly comforting the distraught mother.
It's been almost 2 weeks since that horrible woman took my daughter away from me, Cinderella said.
I never thought I could feel like this inside. I never thought I could be so miserable.
Sleeping Beauty dabbed the tears spilling from her friend's tired eyes.
You have to stay strong, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty said. We have to be brave for our people.
Cinderella blew her nose into a handkerchief.
But who's supposed to be brave for us at a time like this?
She asked.
When the rest of the world is looking to us for strength and guidance, who do we look up to for reassurance?
Sleeping Beauty gently took Cinderella's hand in her own.
We have to inspire each other, she said.
Cinderella patted her friend's hand and placed her head on Sleeping Beauty's shoulder. There was a knock at the door.
Come in, Cinderella said.
Sir Lambton stepped into the Queen's chambers. His face was so long, the Queens knew he wasn't bearing good news.
What is it, Sir Lambton?
Cinderella asked, bracing herself for whatever it was.
More bad news, I'm afraid, Your Majesty, he said. I just received a letter from Sir Grant in the Northern Kingdom. Apparently, the Enchantress attacked the Northern Kingdom last night after attacking troll and goblin territory. They woke up this morning to discover all their crops had been poisoned.
Dear God,
Sleeping Beauty said, and placed a hand on her chest.
Does the Enchantress have no soul?
Queen Snow White has asked that we send what we can, Lambton added.
Yes, of course, Cinderella said. Gather as much food as the kingdom can spare.
The ground under the palace began to shake. Cinderella's chambers rattled as something moved through the palace toward her chambers.
What on earth?
Lambton said, staring down at the floor as it began to crack under his feet. He retrieved his sword, although it was useless against what was coming. Vines burst through the floor and slithered up to Queen Cinderella and Queen Sleeping Beauty. They wrapped around them and dragged them back from where they had come from. Sir Lambton tried rescuing the queens, but it had all happened too quickly to prevent. He looked through the cracks in the floor. He could see the vines dragging the screaming queens several floors through the palace and into the ground where they disappeared out of sight. The ground began to rumble again, this time not from something directly below the palace, but from something much further in the distance. Lambton ran over the cracks to a window to see what was causing all the commotion. Miles away, in the northern part of the Charming Kingdom, a gargantuan pillar made of rock, roots, and dirt emerged from the ground and rocketed into the air. The land cracked and elevated unevenly for miles and miles around it. The pillar grew higher and higher, only stopping once it had reached the clouds. A massive coliseum was on the top of the pillar, constructed of enormous jagged stones shaped like arrowheads. Vines and thorn bushes grew up the sides of the pillar, taking with them all the rulers they had seized from around the world. The enchantress sat in the center of the coliseum on her old fairy council chair like it was a throne. The plants arrived with her guests and pinned them around to the walls at various heights and angles around her. The abducted kings, queens, and fairies were now prisoners in Esmia's vengeful, earthy web. True to her word, the enchantress had built herself a pedestal made of the deepest part of the earth, powered by the deepest anger of her soul. Chapter 26. The Enchantress's Most Prized Possession. The ground began to tremble and quake under the campsite.
What's happening? Connor yelled.
It's the Enchantress, Alex screamed. She's starting her final attack. As if tiny explosions were being set off around the camp, bouquets of devilish vines burst through the ground and slithered through the site. They knocked over tents and people as they moved, as if they were searching for something. Jack and Goldilocks immediately drew their weapons and began slicing the demonic plants, but there were too many of them to fight off.
Help!
The twins heard a high-pitched scream behind them. They turned around and saw the vines tangle around Red and attempt to drag her back into the ground with them.
Someone help me!
Jack and Froggy both ran to her, throwing themselves on the ground and reaching a hand toward her. Red was almost all the way underground. Only one of her hands was free. She looked to Jack and then to Froggy. If these were the last moments of her life, she had to decide right then and there who she wanted to spend them with. Red grabbed hold of Froggy's hand. He was shocked to see her hand land in his.
You chose me?
Froggy said, looking into her eyes. Both of them recognized the significance of this moment.
Yes, I choose you,
Red said, and a small smile appeared on her face. She pulled him a little closer and kissed his slimy green lips, not repulsed by his appearance or texture whatsoever. The vines climbed over Red and began wrapping around Froggy, too. Jack grabbed hold of one of his legs, and Goldilocks grabbed the other. The vines were too strong for them to pull Froggy and Red free, but Jack and Goldilocks weren't giving up. The vines moved past Froggy and began growing around the whole group, pulling all four of them toward the ground. Alex and Connor were on their way to help when they heard another cry.
Butterboy!
Trobella yelled from across the camp. The vines had wrapped around her and were dragging her into the ground, too. Connor grunted and looked around.
Can someone else save Trobella?
He called out, but all the other trolls and goblins were too afraid of the vines to go near her.
Save me, Butterboy!
Trobella cried.
Okay, fine. I'm coming, Connor yelled.
He and Alex changed their course and ran for the young troll queen instead. Connor grabbed Trobella's hands, and Alex grabbed Connor's feet. They tried to pull her free, but the vines were too strong.
This would be so romantic if it weren't for the possessed plants pulling us apart, Butterboy,
Trobella whispered dreamily into Connor's ear. The vines began to creep past Trobella and onto Connor, pulling him with her.
Alex, you have to let go of me, Connor yelled behind himself. You can't let the vines get you.
I'm not letting you go, Connor,
Alex yelled back.
You have to save the fairy tale world, Alex, Connor said. You have to save the other world, and Mom too.
Alex's grip around her brother's feet tightened.
I can't save anything without you, she said.
Yes, you can, he said. It was always meant to be you.
You're the one who got us here, and you're the one who's going to get us out. You heard the ghosts. You're the heir of magic.
You've got to defeat the Enchantress so this world can go on.
The vines had wrapped almost completely around Connor. Alex was shaking her head profusely.
I can't do it alone, she said, terrified to lose him. Yes, you can, Connor said. I'm really sorry about this.
Connor kicked Alex off of him, and the vines consumed him entirely. They dragged him and Trobella down to the ground and disappeared.
Connor!
Alex yelled after him, but it was no use. He was gone. Alex looked across the camp, just in time to see the vines pull Red, Froggy, Jack, and Goldilocks into the ground with one final heave. As soon as Trobella, Red, and the others clinging onto them had been taken away, all the vines in the campsite disappeared into the ground. They had come for the queens. Alex got to her feet and looked around in shock. In a matter of minutes, all of her friends and her brother had been taken from her. She had no choice but to finish their quest alone. It was all up to her now. Bob ran up to Alex.
Where have they been taken?
Alex was wondering the same thing. She looked down at the large cracks the vines had left in the ground. They weren't just in the campsite, but stretched off into the distance, as if the vines had left marks on their way to and from their destination.
I have to go, Alex said.
She ran to their tent and retrieved the Wand of Wonderment. She placed it in the troll's satchel and threw it over her shoulder. Alex ran off into the distance, following the cracks in the ground as if they were a trail.
Where are you going?
Bob asked as he ran after her, but she didn't respond.
Alex!
He tried chasing after her, but she was a third of his age and ran three times as fast as him. Alex never stopped running. Her feet hit the ground in rhythm with her racing heart. She was fueled by adrenaline, but mostly by fear. She could have sworn she heard Red screams and Connor shouts as they were dragged under the ground below her. She prayed she'd get to the Enchantress before she could harm her brother or the others, and wished with all her might that once she got there, she would have a plan to take Esmea's most prized possession away from her. Alex had to think of a way to steal Esmea's pride, not only for a moment, but for the rest of her life. What could she say or do to her that the Enchantress would take to heart and not brush off? How could Alex emotionally scar Esmea so deeply that her pride would never return completely? Could an evil Enchantress take to heart anything that was said or done by a 13-year-old girl? Esmea had spent a century imprisoning the souls of kings, soldiers, and fairies in jars. Was someone like Alex capable of leaving a mark on someone like that? Then, like a flash of lightning, Alex realized something for the first time. The disadvantage was actually in her favor. It was because she was a 13-year-old that she had a greater chance of bruising the Enchantress's ego. If Alex could muster up enough courage to say something to the Enchantress that a king or fairy never had the bravery to before, perhaps it would have an even greater effect on her. Alex had to choose her words wisely, though. She had to get straight to the point and straight to the punch. The Enchantress wouldn't be listening for very long. It had to work, because Alex had run out of ideas and out of time. After following the cracks in the ground for hours, Alex found herself staring up in horror at the Enchantress's new home in the Charming Kingdom. The vines dragged Queen Red and Queen Trobella and the people who clutched onto them for miles and miles underground. They reached the Charming Kingdom and were pulled up the sides of a massive pillar of earth and into the menacing Colosseum on top of it. The vines instantly pinned the newcomers to the walls. Froggy was hung upside down next to Red. Jack and Goldilocks were pinned together, each with their weapon hand behind them. Connor scanned the Colosseum and was sad to see they weren't alone. Hung across the wall from top to bottom were Queen Snow White and King Chandler, Queen Cinderella and King Chance, Queen Sleeping Beauty and King Chase, Queen Rapunzel, and the members of the Fairy Council. And now, with the inclusion of Red and Trobella, the entire Happily Ever After assembly was at the Enchantress's mercy.
Oh, good. We're all here, Esmea said upon Red and Trobella's arrival.
The Enchantress sat imperially on her golden throne. Her hair and cape flowed around her more aggressively than ever. Rumpelstiltskin peeked out from behind the throne, looking regretfully at all the confined monarchs around the room. A large crater was indented in the floor, with a small magenta fire burning a pile of skulls like firewood in the center of it. Six glass turquoise jars were placed in a line in front of the Enchantress. Connor knew his grandmother was trapped inside one of them, and to Connor's horror, as he looked around the room, his grandmother wasn't the only member of his family being held prisoner in the Colosseum. Pinned to the wall across from him, in a giant birdcage, was Connor's mother. She cradled Princess Hope in her arms. The child's cries echoed through the Colosseum. The taller princess could see her mother tangled in the vines beside her and reach through the bars of the cage toward her.
Mama!
Princess Hope cried.
It's going to be all right, darling,
Cinderella said, hoping it wasn't a lie. Charlotte's jaw dropped and the little color in her face drained away as soon as she saw her son.
Connor,
she mouthed, so thrilled yet so terrified to see him in such a horrible place.
Mom,
he silently mouthed back.
Where's your sister?
She asked. Connor wasn't sure what the best answer was to give her.
Safe,
he decided to say. Esmia stood at her throne.
Let's begin, shall we?
She said. The enchantress gazed around the Colosseum with her index finger pressed tightly to her lips, as if she was a little girl in a candy shop.
Let's start with the Charming Kingdom,
Esmia said. The vines began to rustle. The plants hoisted Cinderella and King Chance off of the walls and forced them into a kneeling position on the ground in front of the crater.
You soulless monster,
Cinderella yelled up at her.
Let our daughter go, King Chance demanded.
If you want your daughter back, then renounce your throne and hand your kingdom over to me,
Esmia said to him, as if it were a simple decision.
You will never have my kingdom,
King Chance yelled. The enchantress glared at him through her long lashes.
Fine,
she said. Esmia snapped her fingers, and her vines reached through the cage and pulled Princess Hope out of Charlotte's arms. The child was screaming. Tears and snot ran down her terrified face. The vines dangled the princess over the flames of the fire.
No!
Cinderella screamed.
Do it, Chance, just do it!
She begged her husband. King Chance looked to all the other kings and queens around the room, but no one pleaded with him otherwise. The world they had tried to protect with honor and integrity was long gone.
Very well, King Chance said. I renounce my throne and my kingdom to you, Esmia.
As he spoke these words, the enchantress threw back her head, and her victorious laugh filled the Colosseum. The flames in the crater grew higher, and a trail of thick black smoke began to fill the sky.
Now is that so hard?
Esmia asked with a large grin. She snapped her fingers again, and the vines dropped Princess Hope into her mother's arms. The family was only reunited for a moment before the vines jerked them back against the wall.
Let's move on to the Fairy Kingdom,
Esmia said with a bright smile. The vines brought the seven fairies off the wall and to the edge of the crater.
You know what to say, Emeralda,
Esmia said, and leisurely inspected her nails.
Make it quick so we can finish this at a decent hour. Or do you need further persuasion as well?
The vines wrapped around the jar containing the fairy godmother's soul and held it over the fire. All the fairies shouted for it to be released.
If it makes your cruel wrath come to an end any sooner, fine. I hand over the fairy kingdom to you,
Emeralda said, against her will. The flame in the crater grew even higher, and the black smoke thickened. Esmia closed her eyes and soaked up the moment for all it was worth. Her whole body tingled with triumph. She had waited centuries for this, and it was all finally happening. One by one, the enchantress called the monarchs before her and forced them to give up their kingdoms. Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, Rapunzel, and Trabella all renounced their thrones with teary eyes and heavy hearts. And with each surrender, the magenta flames rose higher and higher, and the smoke condensed.
I just have one thing to say to you before you put me back on the wall,
Trabella said, begrudgingly staring at Esmia with intense eyes.
You stop my dancing, and you will never be forgiven.
The enchantress, along with every other person in the Colosseum, stared oddly at the small troll queen, not knowing what to make of her statement. Finally, there was only one ruler left to relinquish her throne.
Last but certainly not least, I call Queen Red Riding Hood of the Red Riding Hood Kingdom to the floor.
Red gave a small squeal at the sound of her name. The vines lifted her to the front of the crater. Froggy fought desperately against the vines hanging him as she was moved.
Queen Red, do you willingly surrender your kingdom to me?
The enchantress asked, as if she already counted on Red's submission. Red looked up at Froggy and at Jack and Goldilocks for strength. She knew that with her renunciation, the enchantress would have successfully conquered the world.
Well, Red peeped, I'm not sure I'm in a position to do that.
All trace of accomplishment vanished from Esmia's face. As if it weren't already impossibly high, the tension in the Colosseum grew.
Excuse me?
Esmia asked with a terrifying scowl. Red went pale.
It's easy to explain,
Red said. Her hands trembled as she spoke.
Unlike everyone else here, I'm an elected queen. My kingdom doesn't necessarily belong to me. It belongs to all the Hoodians.
Connor, Jack, Froggy, and Goldilocks were beaming proudly at her. Even if Red had only bought them a minute, it was a minute not owned by the enchantress. Esmia continued to gaze frighteningly at Red, and contemplate her next move.
Very well, she said. I'll just have every last person in your kingdom killed until you-